Intervju Radija Študent.
V tokratnem Eriš intervjuju se pogovarjamo o dogodkih z periferije imperija. S to bomo spomnili na misel Hanne Arendt, ki je opozorila, da je pojav fašizma le uporaba kolonialnih praks domačim prebivalstvom. Kevin Annett je bivši protestantski duhovnik, ki je v kanadski zahodni provinci v Britanski Kolumbiji zavzel mesto duhovnika. Poseduje diplomo iz antropologije in doktorat iz politične znanosti. Kevin, welcome to the station.
Thank you.
Soon after starting your new job, you noticed something is terribly wrong with the residence. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, the first Indian home I ever visited, the woman and the man there told me a story of how their best friend had been killed in the local Indian boarding school that was run by my church. And I began to hear many of those stories of children who had died, and so I realized that this was not something people were just making up. It was, you know, a terrible history that nobody had been talking about. And so I began to investigate, and I found that there were many, many of those incidents that had happened in the schools.
The Native American population was isolated from the white majority. That is almost a consequence of the authorities forcibly taking children from their parents and putting them in residential schools. Is that right?
That's right. There was a law in Canada in 1920 that every Indian child had to be in one of these boarding schools or their parents would go to jail. And because of that policy of forced internment or imprisonment in these schools, we estimate that as many as 50,000 children died over a century in these schools because of malnutrition and disease that in many cases was being deliberately introduced among the students. So we believe it was an attempt to actually get rid of many Indians so that the white settlers can come in and get the land. And that is part of the reason of running these schools.
The schools were supposedly educational facilities, but children didn't learn there, as we hear. What did their day look like?
Well, the children were given very little education. They'd get up early at about 6 in the morning. They would be given food that was very poor, rancid and decaying food. They would be forced to work in the fields or scrubbing the walls, and they would get a little bit of education, just what they needed to learn to read and write, and lots of religious instruction. And so it was not really education. They were being trained almost to be a slave population, you know, and still to this day, most Indian people don't have jobs, they don't have an education. And again, it's because of that legacy of what happened in these schools.
It was noted that these schools were used as a tool to disintegrate the sense of Native American culture mm-hmm. in the children. But what were the methods, everyday methods or the more brutal methods that were used to coerce the children?
Well, terror, massive terror and trauma. They would be regular beatings. One woman told me that it was the policy in this one school run by the Catholics that whenever you were brought in, their heads were shaved and then children were either beaten or raped. In order to force their compliance. And that was common. I've heard those stories all over Canada whenever I speak to groups of Indian people. You know, for 15 years now, I've been hearing exactly that same story. So it was regular trauma. It was not being fed properly, you know, being forced to sleep in very cold and lonely conditions and never being able to see your parents or be able to be shown any kind of love. So all of that tends to create people who are very scared and very, very sick people. And that's why still to this day, many Native people are dying off in Canada at a very high rate compared to Canadians. Yep.
So let me get this right. It was like rape was an everyday method of coercion.
That's right. It wasn't just because of bad priests. It was because of a policy that it was okay to do that to Indian people.
This policy would nowadays more philosophically be regarded as, should we call that, a joint venture of state and church to eradicate native culture and seize their property. Were there connections between capital and cultural interests?
Very much. There was the church and state cooperated together, but then it was also an attempt to get the resources and the land of the native people. So, for example, these schools were often built where there were valuable fishing or timber, minerals. It was a way to access those resources. So there's always been an economic incentive as well in getting native people off their land, and that still carries on today.
There were also documents of medical experiments that involved German-speaking doctors. There have been rumors that Project Paperclip, which is an U.S. Mandated import of Nazi scientists after World War II, that Nazis could actually continue their experiments on Indian and Native children.
That's right. And Project Paperclip after World War II did bring more Nazi war criminals and scientists into Canada than any country in the world. That's because the Americans were bringing in many of them through Canada in order to work on their space program, their military programs. Children in schools were used by these doctors and others in medical experiments. We have the testimonies of people about that. We also know that even before World War II, in the 1930s, there were German doctors coming over. In this one school on Vancouver Island, near to where I live, they were people have told me that in 1939, there were German doctors giving them shots, which caused many of these children to die, shots in the chest, and using them in drug testing and various experiments. So, I mean, this is, again, part of this history that happened, to Indians.
You are also mentioning there were the experiments with eugenics, that they were sterilizing people that were deemed as, not worthy of having further generations.
Yeah, the eugenics laws started in America. Hitler adopted them later, but they were, in fact, started in America and Canada in the late 19th century. And there were laws brought in Canada during the 1920s and 30s, which made it legal to sterilize any Native person. So we know that there were probably thousands of Native women sterilized in Western Canada if they didn't go to church, if they were traditional and they held onto their land or their language, they would be forced to be sterilized. And as a matter of fact, I've spoken to a number of men who said that if their marks were too high in school, if they were particularly smart, then they would also be sterilized. So under international conventions, those are crimes against humanity. It means you're trying to wipe out a group of people from breeding. And the thing to remember is that this was churches and government and local doctors and that working together to do those kinds of crimes. So that's why we say there should be a war crimes trial in Canada and the United States to look at these crimes,
You estimate that more than 50% of children died. Experts have identified possible sites of mass burial. Despite of the authorities' admission of past crimes, they won't let the graves be dug out. Where does that take you in your fight?
Well, we know we released a list 2 years ago to the press that there's 28 mass grave sites in Western Canada. We've asked the police to investigate, and they refuse. As a matter of fact, they not only refuse, but they threaten people that if you try to look into it, they'll face arrest. And so the government and the churches are colluding with the police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, in concealing these crimes. And that's why I'm in Europe and have had to go outside Canada, because things are very censored and controlled in Canada about this. And what we're hoping is that there will be an international intervention, that we will bring in forensic experts and the media from other countries to come into those sites so that we can do an examination and determine the cause of death and also bring the remains of these children back to their families for a proper burial. That's part of what we're campaigning to do now.
We are here talking about a first world country. Actually, it's a country that we like to look up to, actually. And this assimilation policy could be summed up as a directive to kill the Indian in the child. Official apologies declared that it was the process of boarding schools and educating the Indians was conducted in the best intention. Would you say that this controversial practice was systematically enforced, or was it the result of abuse in the lower ranks?
It was a policy that was brought in, and everyone who worked in the system had to go along with it or they'll lose their job. So it wasn't just that they were in the lower ranks people doing these crimes, because they were never punished when they did these crimes. It was the government ordering people to do it, and the churches as well, ordering their employees to do it.
So it was a top-down directive.
Yes.
Yeah. You have mentioned that Native Americans, they don't have a status of citizenship in Canada. They are subject directly to the crown. Actually, the crown of British Empire owns the land.
Yeah.
The Indians are just residents there.
Yes, that's right. And it comes down to this question of land, because as long as the crown claims to hold all the land, Native people can't have a livelihood. They're strangers and refugees in their own country that they've lived in for thousands of years. And they're deliberately kept in that condition by a law called the Indian Act, which says that Indians are not citizens. They are wards of the state, which means legally they're like children. They can't conduct their own affairs or own land or anything. So you do that to maintain people in a condition of powerlessness and so you can get their lands and resources. I mean, it's really that simple.
But people are integrated on a political level. There are native politicians, and what do they do? Don't they have...
The native leaders are on the government payroll, and so they're controlled because of that. A lot of the support we get is from just ordinary people on the ground, because once you're locked into the government system, these native leaders have not spoken out about the crimes that occurred in the schools. They're very much puppet politicians, and that's why we have to encourage a lot of ordinary Indians just to come forward, and those are the ones who have spoken about these things.
What is the reaction in Europe? How do people react here?
Very supportive. I mean, wherever I go, people are shocked because they had a view of Canada very different. They said, well, we know Americans kill our Indians. We didn't know Canadians did. And so I've had support in many countries, England and Ireland and other countries where people suffered the same abuse in these churches. I hear many similar stories in other countries about how these crimes occurred all over the world. So we're hopeful that in September in London, we're holding a tribunal where many of these stories can be documented and told. And that's one of the reasons I'm here.
What little we know about this grim past is due to your fight to uncover the truth. Natives call you Eagle Strong Voice. Please tell us about your experience on the receiving end of the repression. What happened to you?
Oh, well, I lost my job in the United Church when I began to talk about these things. I lost my family and my children. The church helped my wife in her divorce, and so it actually was a way to try to stop me from operating. I haven't been able to work. I've been pretty much blacklisted. And legal and physical attacks and those kinds of things. But at the same time, I've received much support from natives in getting the story out, and that's why they gave me the name. I was adopted into the Ojibwe or Anishinaabe nation in Winnipeg. And to me, it's just proof that when you're standing on the truth, you have a great power, even if you're just one person or a few people, and that's what's kept me going.
You are having tomorrow. You are having you are speaking in Kino Dvor. What will you talk about, and what is you?
Well, the meeting tomorrow night is about. I'll be showing a clip from my film Unrepentant. And I'll be talking about this whole story and receiving questions and comments and other things from the audience, so that I can just try to educate people here about what really happened and showing them part of our film and everything. And, there's also the websites people can go to as well if they want to learn more.
That's right. The web naslov, spletni naslov je hiddenfromhistory.org ali hiddennolonger.com. No torej... Kevin Anet bo jutri, 2. marca, ob 19. uri v Kino Dvoru imel bo predavanje in tam bo si tudi lahko kupili njegovo knjigo. Thank you, Kevin, for this interview.
Thank you for having me and I hope to see you again. I'll be back in the summer.
Thank you.
Intervju Radija Študent.